This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This is the time of year that we get family members together. Sometimes it's just couples, sometimes it's entire families together for the holidays. And there are a number of stresses that could make some big impacts on relationships with spouses or partners. A few statistics to toss out here. First off, according to some of the stats, 44% of women and 31% of men report that their stress levels are higher than normal over the holidays, and that in turn could cause some problems. Well, we wanted to check in with some local experts about this, and one in particular we have here in the studio today. Barbara Dahl is the director of the IU Northwest Counseling Center. And in her job on the Gary campus, she gets to talk to students and faculty and staff, a lot of people that have particular problems with stresses. A lot of them, of course, are education related. That is to say, students may have some part problems with dealing with classes and family members and the like, too. But this time of year is especially bad. So I think that maybe the same techniques, I suppose, probably can do well for not only for students dealing with their on-campus stresses, but family members as well, too. And Barbara, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, one of the things I know that we talk a lot about here, we see, of course, a lot on Facebook, will be some relationship changes. That's one of the things that apparently some people notice first. Because they're on Facebook so much, especially if they know couples or they know a man and a wife, they know a family member of some kind, whether it's a daughter or son, whatever they may happen to see, and keep a close eye on their friends and the like, and they may see these changes pop up in the profiles on the social media that we have. What are sometimes these first indicators that everybody else seems to get? And of course, they may be. Maybe a little bit too late to deal with the problems. Who knows? But the idea is what are the indicators that folks know that there might be some kind of relationship issue brewing in the background?
Well, one of the things that we certainly teach our students, and just a clarification, our office, we just work with the students. We refer faculty and staff to IU's Employee Assistance Program. But one of the things that often we help students figure out is what are the indicators of a healthy relationship versus an unhealthy relationship. And figuring some of that out certainly leads to the ability to be in one or not be in one. And so some of the things that happen with unhealthy relationships is, imbalance in power, control, and those types of things. Being in a relationship is stressful. Mm-hmm. Being in an unhealthy relationship is far more stressful.
What are some of the indicators that you notice, or then your colleagues there at the counseling center notice, if there's a problem that's come up, if somebody comes to you and say, I need some help, I've got to talk with somebody about this issue or whatever it may be, what kind of indicators do you usually get to work with to know that there may be a problem that might have to have, certainly if not your own help, some professional help as well, too?
Absolutely. We're all licensed clinical staff in the office. And one of the things, again, like I say, that stress that's associated with being controlled or controlling in a relationship, that can be a strong indicator that something is unhealthy going on. So if a client comes into our office, a student who's a client, and is feeling like they're being controlled in a relationship, they feel like they're losing their own identity, their self-identity. Everything that they're doing is because their person that they're in the relationship with, we call them intimate partner relationships, they're doing what that person wants them to do. So losing one's own sense of self is an indicator of an unhealthy relationship.
Do you notice sometimes, and I know this is the extreme, and we've had folks with the St. Jude House on with this to talk about the about the problems that sometimes crop up, especially in dealing with abuse, whether it's physical or whether it's psychological or whether it's financial abuse, which is another type that I think people don't think about as possibly happening in a relationship. But do you find sometimes that these might be the first indicators of something that's more serious that may come up?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that financial, you're right, that can be very subtle. And it can go one of two ways. Our population, our average age of use is about 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we have young women who are the financial breadwinners in the relationships that they're in, whether it's a marital relationship or a dating relationship. And that can be a form of abuse in that someone else is controlling their money. The other way financially that can come up is that, you know, the breadwinner is using those dollars or that money to keep the person in the relationship because mm-hmm. they can't afford to be on their own in the relationship. So there are subtleties that come up. You know, like you say, the financial, emotional abuse, we find that goes on a lot. Now with the advent of technology and social media, telephones that usually connect us 24/7. I had a young person tell me that their boyfriend has an app on their phone that tracks where they are at all times. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of different ways that indicate unhealthy relationships and you know, abuses of power can be one of them. Mm-hmm.
Some information I also came across here from Match.com mentioned that they found in their studies that 76% of singles said their relationship had dissolved before, during, or after the holidays. So I guess with that being said, it probably means it's a good indication why there may be later in the first of the year after a holiday is when you start to see divorce rates start to increase.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, Chris, what happens sometimes with couples, whether they are married couples who've been married for a number of years, or again, we call them intimate partner relationships, someone dating, around the holidays, there are expectations that people have about what the holidays should be, what they want them to be. And sometimes that's not the reality. And when that partner fails to meet those expectations, whether they are spoken or not, that can be the end of a relationship, whether that's you know, appropriate or not. That does happen. So those statistics do not surprise me at all.
Well, we talked about the statistics, about the problems and how they seem to manifest themselves, sometimes crop up in just a discussion with people. If we may, let's take some issues here and kind of break them down and come up with some ideas on how to deal with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're talking in general here about stress, and we've talked in general about what happens in relationships that stress can cause the problems. How can you deal with that?
Right. Well, stress, I think that sometimes we think that stress is avoidable. It isn't, whether you're in a relationship, not in a relationship. So stress is something, is a form of discomfort or inability to manage a lot of things at one time that we can all experience, whether we're in a relationship or not. And what we try to help our clients deal with is managing that stress, you know, managing the changes that occur in a relationship, managing the changes that come in life, and being able to bounce back from those. We have resiliency workshops and groups that we offer because I don't think that there is any way to avoid stress. There have been studies that indicate even babies are under stress at times. So just managing the stress that we have, we unfortunately can't avoid it. And the holidays can bring about a unique circumstance, a unique set of circumstances, I should say, with stress.
Mm-hmm. One point that was brought up, I took a look at in getting some notes together today, was finding something which I had not heard at least a term, or maybe this person made it up, I don't know, but they talk about cope-aheads. Mm-hmm. I guess ways that one can come up with strategies to try to minimize not only the stress, but the potential for creating stress when they get people together for the holidays.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And, you know, I kind of teach and encourage people to think about, again, stress management and anticipation. And I break it down, you know, everything. We're in college. We're on a university. We're on a campus. So, you know, education is central. So I call it the ABCs. And anticipation is the first A. And acceptance is along with that. But anticipation, you know, what types of stressors do you anticipate upcoming with the holiday? Sometimes people are not aware of what causes them stress with the holiday. And it is important to look at that, to plan ahead, if you will. It's not to plan ahead to stress, but plan ahead to manage the stress that you are probably going to have. have. So anticipating, you know, if last Christmas or Christmas past are stressful for you because you are the primary wage earner in your home and you're expected to do the gift shopping or provide the dollars for the gift shopping, then you have to plan ahead with setting aside a little money, you know, at the beginning of the year so that you won't feel that great stress. Anticipating what you know, and that's based on your experience and what has happened in the past, usually.
Is it possible for an individual or a couple or even a whole family, for that matter, too, to be able to figure out a way to divide up the time that you have to spend so that you can spend time as an individual as well as a couple or a family to kind of reduce the stresses?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is along with that acceptance, that other A, mm-hmm. that you have to accept, you know, that we all get the same 24 hours in each day that we have, whether it's during the holiday season or it's in the middle of the summer. So it's the same 24 hours. And sometimes we unrealistically expect that we're going to do more with those 24 hours in the course of, you know, our planning and excitement and anticipation of the holidays, and that's just not so. So having a sit-down conversation, communication is key. Looking at a calendar, you know, the Christmas holiday seems to come at breakneck pace after we, you know, put those leftovers up after Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we all really wrap our minds fully around that. So I think that actually sitting down with a partner or with a family and saying, hey, this is the calendar. You know, if they're young children and they're school activities to attend, if they're in-laws, I mean, you know, this is what we can do with the time that we have.
We're talking with Barbara Dahl, who is the director of the IU Northwest Counseling Center. And we talk about the holiday stresses that can damage relationships. I've read that it's not a bad idea if you come up with some kind of holiday tradition for yourself or you and your spouse or your partner or whoever it may be or the family members to be able to set up some time. As you say, it kind of goes with what you mentioned about dividing up the time and making sure the stresses can be avoided if possible.
Absolutely.
Is setting up a simple routine like that a good idea?
Absolutely. And that you know, I see it, you know, because I'm, you know, in higher ed, most things are centered around education. So, you know, I see it. I was going to talk about the ABCs. So that is a wonderful segue into the letter B. And that's setting boundaries. You know, real boundaries. These are the things that we can do. We can't say yes to everything. I can't say yes to everything. You know, if you're the individual, sometimes just traditionally, I'm not saying this is always the way it is, but in traditional roles, sometimes, you know, if it's a mom and dad situation, the mom is the one who's coordinating the activities or, you know, buying the or making the cookies for the cookie exchange or whatever. So sometimes having to say no, setting that boundary and behavior following through with it, setting the boundary of, no, I'm just not able to do that. That's not going to fit into the schedule.
Is that, I guess, in a way that's trying to be flexible, if at all possible?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As flexible as you can be with mm-hmm. still, again, setting those boundaries. And I think that, again, that sometimes what we do is we overlook in our eager anticipation of all the joy and happiness that the holiday is for many people, not for everyone, that we overbook ourselves. We over, you know, schedule. And so setting those boundaries and being flexible with those boundaries. You know, if you have three events in one day, maybe that's doable. But if they're all three events at the same time, 30 miles apart, that's not realistic.
Is it possible to include in some of the ways that you cope with these problems that create stresses during the holidays is a sense of humor?
Absolutely. Sense of humor is always in order. You know, I laugh at myself often. You know, we have to be able to laugh at ourselves and laugh with each other. You know, if we did a double booking and someone wound up being at one place and, you know, the rest of the family is at the other place, you know, find a way to laugh it off. You know, make your apologies and not associating that mistake with any hidden agenda. Mm-hmm. It's just, again, like I say, sometimes a mistake and, you know, something that happens when we overbook, double book. So being able to laugh at ourselves, being able to ask ourselves, is this going to matter 5 minutes from now? Is this going to matter 5 hours from now? Probably not. So, you know what, let's not take it or make it more serious than what it actually is.
And I guess the last point I want to check on is if it's not still not a bad idea, especially for couples and for husbands and wives to try and maintain the intimate relationship during the holidays like this to try to avoid problems that can crop up later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that brings me to my C's, ABCs. Mm-hmm. So that's the self-care, the companion care. Caring about your companion, whoever that is, being compassionate, staying connected. All of those C's are very important to be mindful of at any time during the year in a relationship, but specifically during the holidays where expectations, you know, of company gatherings, of family gatherings, of, again, you know, school Christmas pageants, whatever the responsibilities are. So being loving and staying connected and that companion care and that self-care to keep that the intimacy in that relationship beyond the holidays.
Is there any way that, although we're not studying up like for an exam in college or anything like that, is there any place we can find some information that's available out there that if we have concerns, we can do a little self-study so that we can in turn be prepared for the stresses of the holiday?
Well, absolutely. And not just for the stresses of the holiday, Chris, but just stressors in general. The NAMI, we call, you know, everything is an acronym now, but it's the National Alliance for Mental Illness. They have a wonderful website, NAMI. NAMI.org, of just all sort of tips, ways you can assist someone who struggles with maybe depression during the holidays, where, you know, that can be exacerbated sometimes. SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA.gov. Mm-hmm. That's another great website that persons can go to just find out tips to cope, you know, how to cope during stressful times, how to navigate around holiday times when you may not be connected with someone, when you may be in the throes of a relationship that's ending.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much for the information and for looking at this in more detail and a little bit of advice there, too, I suppose we probably should take. We could always use a little help if we have questions, and we appreciate you spending time with us to share this information with us as we all get ready for the bigger holidays coming up here by the end of the month.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Barbara Dahl. She's the director of the IU Northwest Counseling Center about some of the holiday stresses that can do some real damage if they're unchecked to relationships, and that's either family members or spouses or couples as well. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We've seen some good numbers coming in here for the last few months from the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. Let's find out the latest for October. We have Pete Novak, who's the president CEO of GNIAR, as the abbreviation goes. And Pete, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris.
Well, bring us up to date here on how the seven counties in the association did on home sales and the median home selling prices these days.
Yeah, I mean, we've continued to maintain a pretty strong year, and I would say maybe about 4, 5, 6 months ago, the national numbers started to show a little bit of a slowdown in terms of sales. Buyers were pushing back a little bit because prices have just gotten pretty high all across the country, quite frankly. And so I think, you know, buyers kind of were slowing down a little bit. There was still very limited inventory going on. And so there was just, you know, fierce competition. But we didn't really see that here in Northwest Indiana. We maintained pretty strong numbers throughout that time, but it was probably a signal that might happen here in Northwest Indiana. And it's possible that it still could, but at the same time, we've remained pretty strong. We've been outpacing the national numbers thus far.
I've seen that at least for the month of October here, it kind of varies by county to county, whether you've had a good sales month for October or a not-so-good sales month, I guess. But most of the counties seem like, with the exception, I think, of Pulaski and maybe some of the other smaller counties, they've done pretty well.
Yeah, when you look at the monthly numbers, sometimes they can be deceiving because it just depends on the number of properties that sold, and you know, and it also depends again on the month you're comparing it to the year prior. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get anomalies in there. But when we look at those counties, you know, for the year to date, they're all pretty similar, all pretty solid. I mean, Lake County year to date has been up 2% in sales on the year, up over 6% in prices on the year. Porter County, for example, up over 5% on the number of homes sold on the year, and almost at 5% on median selling price. So all of those represent, you know, what still is a pretty strong market, still representing that it's a seller's market because prices are rising so high. And I think that'll be the question going into next year. There's some people looking at the numbers saying that they're starting to see the market shift a little bit, not necessarily turn for the worse, but shift a little bit away from being such a strong seller's market and favoring back to the buyer a little bit. It'll, it probably still will remain a seller's market, but the pendulum just swinging back towards the middle a little bit. And that remains to be seen, but I think some of the numbers might, you know, they might show that. One of the things that we're seeing that might help with that whole case a little bit is that inventory is starting to hit the market, and we've been saying for the last 4 years that we've been starving for inventory, and that's been a true story. You can look at the numbers. You can look at how prices rose dramatically during that time, and this will be a good thing because it'll provide for a little bit more balanced market, which I think we would always prefer.
Well, I'll just give one little example. I just happened to notice on my way driving around on Ridge Road in Highland the other day, going from one point to another, running some errands. I go along the route there, and you never see very many houses that seem to be up for sale. But yesterday, I noticed there are a lot more for sale signs, and they're not for sale by owner. They're for sale by established realtors up there. So I noticed that obviously you go through these cycles, and we have a lot of people, obviously, that in many cases are retirees, and maybe they've decided to downsize. So they don't want the big house anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's really been the mystery question, I guess, if you will, for the last 3 or 4 years, is we've been telling people, hey, inventory's real low, and then, of course, the next question is, well, why is it low? You know, why aren't sellers selling? And honestly, there was not one clear-cut answer for that, but I think, you know, prices have risen so much, interest rates are starting to rise. I think sellers are starting to look at that and go, okay, you know, at some point I'm going to be on the opposite side of this, you know, this transaction. I'm going to be a buyer, and I don't want interest rates to rise too high, and I've gotten a fair amount of equity out of my home so far, so let's do it. I mean, I don't know what the exact reason would be, but I know that the numbers would show nationally for the last 3 or 4 months, and here locally in Northwest Indiana for the last 2 months, that the inventory has started to rise, or at least the number of new listings coming on the market are rising, which means sellers are deciding to sell. And again, we all believe that's a positive thing.
Are we noticing more homes being built these days? I know that's something that's always been a problem, that we have spells where we have a big construction projects underway with subdivisions going up around the county and surrounding counties too, not only Lake County but elsewhere. Are we finding more homes in general that are going to be built, or the ones that maybe have been remodeled or are out there on the market now?
Yeah, definitely. Home building has increased. The local home builders have reported that production has increased from previous years, and nationally they're reporting that as well. And that should be no surprise. Again, limited inventory. I think the issue with the builders is that they really can't build their product fast enough to keep up with demand. And I know that may surprise some people, but at the end of the day, you know, they have subcontractors and only so many resources that they can tap into. So there's a little bit of constraint on that side, but I think the numbers would show that that's been improving, and that certainly helps the kind of market that we're in as well. So that also would be very positive things for real estate.
Now, you've kind of given us an indication here going into 2019, at least I would say the first half of the year, because it's hard to predict the entire year, but are we going to likely continue to see some growth? Are we going to, as far as you know, going to continue to see more subdivisions or more houses added to existing subdivisions out there?
Yeah, again, that is the question. I think what we're pretty confident in saying is that if we start to see new listings come onto the market, that should theoretically give buyer more options. It should flatten prices a little bit, not necessarily decrease prices, but maybe lessen the growth that we've been seeing, or flattening the growth that we've been seeing. And that would be a good thing, again, because prices are rising pretty high. First-time home buyers are starting to get priced out in a lot of markets. So, you know, that'll be a question, and that'll also be a question of whether demand is so strong that it actually attracts more buyers back into the market who were previously going, you know what, I'm just not seeing what I like, or I don't want to pay that much. But all of a sudden, if there's more options for them, do they jump in as buyers as well? So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw prices kind of slow a little bit next year, probably still grow, but slow from the pace that we've seen, and then see sales increase because more buyers are in the market and they're finding what they're liking and they're actually moving on it. And again, I think that would indicate a little bit more of a balanced market, and we, again, we're always going to take that if that option's available.
Well, Pete, thanks very much for your insight and for the information from the statistics that have come out from October from the Association of Realtors here in the region. And we hope that we go into 2019 with the following through on the good news that you've kind of predicted so far. That's good to hear.
Yep, absolutely, Chris. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Peter Novak is the President and CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. At one time, railroads crisscrossed the state, carrying just about every type of commodity you can imagine, including people. But now the heyday of railroads seems to be long behind us. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright talked with a listener who wanted to know what happened.
Indiana native and Bloomington resident Scott Shackelford was curious about the state's old passenger train.
I have had the good fortune to live in some wonderful places that actually are pretty well served by public transit. And I was also just kind of curious why at this day and age we don't have something like that in Indiana. And as I dug more into it, you know, we used to. And I've been curious, you know, why did that go away and what could we do to get it back?
In seeking the answers to Shackelford's question, I ended up in Salem, Indiana, where the Monon Railroad Depot once sat. Now, it's a vibrant museum full of Monon artifacts and a massive railway model with immaculate detail in every passenger car and building. It brings Salem, surrounding communities, and the train itself to life. John Campbell is the project director of the model railroad layout.
Well, the layout depicts Washington County, Indiana, and the portion that the Monon Railroad ran through in 1960. We're standing in front of Salem, which is pretty much the midpoint of the county.
The route that later became known as the Monon Railroad got its start in Salem in the 1840s. George Carpenter is the vice president and director of member services for the Monon Railroad Historical Technical Society. He says the train transported all kinds of goods and passengers throughout the state.
The Monon was a completely Indiana railroad. It ran the length of the state from New Albany to Michigan City, with departures out of New Albany to go to Louisville and to go to Chicago.
The Monon reached Bloomington in 1853, following the route of what's now known as the Beeline Trail. The first part of Shackelford's question about why Indiana no longer has a statewide passenger rail line is pretty easy to answer. Carpenter says cars basically drove passenger trains out of business.
Trains were a vital part of our transportation network because roads didn't amount to anything. Roads were often no more than cow paths. They aren't like they are today.
In the 1920s, Indiana had nearly 7,500 miles of railroad tracks. Today, it's about half that number. Large investments have gone toward building and maintaining the state's roads. The Monon stopped transporting passengers in the late 1960s. Shackelford says that doesn't surprise him.
But I hope that we're now kind of coming back around full circle to some of the benefits of this system that we lost.
He's right. There are a lot of benefits, including the ability to work, eat, or sleep. Amtrak operates the Hoosier State Line, which currently takes passengers between Indianapolis and Chicago. But the federal government cut funding for the route in 2013, and funding remains an issue. The train only runs 4 days a week. And as today's generations consider ditching cars and trucks for alternative modes of transportation, an expanded rail line could garner a lot of interest. But I have bad news for Shackelford. Campbell says there really aren't any efforts to bring back a passenger train like the once thriving Monon. He says it's not impossible, but...
Number one, most of the tracks are disappearing, and to not just the cost of rebuilding, the cost of reacquiring right-of-way and then rebuilding couldn't be justified by the ridership.
So now, where IU students and Bloomington residents once loaded into passenger cars, we see walkers, bikers, and runners. Shackelford says that's nice too, but he wishes the state would have done more to preserve what he considers an important part of Indiana's heritage. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
The first female Marine was from Northwest Indiana and the region. She was born in Kokomo. And according to Troy Brownfield, who's a staff writer with the Saturday Evening Post, a woman named Opha Mae Johnson found herself at the front of the line, and she was the first woman to enlist in the U.S. Marine Corps. Brownfield talked with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson recently about the woman pioneer and about the article that he wrote that featured her.
You wrote a profile on Opha Mae Johnson, the first female Marine who enlisted 100 years ago this August. And she's from Northwest Indiana, right?
That's correct. She was born Opha Mae Jacob in Kokomo in 1879.
So tell us about her.
Opha Mae occupies, you know, a very unique place in history, but there's not a terribly large volume of material written about her. So what we know is that she was born in Kokomo, Indiana. She attended Woods Commercial College, and she was the salutatorian there. And she actually graduated from a department in 1895 that was called the Shorthand and Typewriting Department. So she had these administrative skills and this educational background that was already sort of ahead of its time, considering we're talking about 1895. And then we do know that 3 years later, she married Victor Johnson, and he was the musical director of the Lafayette Square Opera House in Washington, D.C. So that is a little bit of what we know about her prior to the time of her enlistment.
So she helped pave the way for the next generation of female Marines and holds, you said, a lasting legacy in the fight for gender equality in American history. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. The reserve for the United States Marine Corps for women had been established in 1916, which was concurrent with the United States' involvement in World War I at the time. Now, coming down toward the end of the war, during the last 2 years, women were allowed to join the various military branches and reserves, and they were allowed to do that because they were covering responsibilities that men under active deployment had, but since they had been shipped out, those responsibilities needed to be covered by other support staff. So, you know, eventually there would be 33,000 women that would serve as support staff across the branches. But, you know, in the case of Johnson, you know, when the announcement came out, you know, on September 1st, or actually it was in August, but the article that covered it was in September 1st, the Richmond Times-Dispatch. In 1918, Johnson went to enlist, and she was the first person. She found herself at the front of the line. And, you know, we often talk about history is written by the people that show up. She happened to show up first, and Private Johnson was the first of over 300 women that enlisted the Marine Corps during the remainder of World War I.
And so what was her service time like? Do you know anything about that? Was it successful?
Yeah, she was sent to Marine Corps headquarters, and she worked as a clerk there. And what she did, ironically enough, was the first assignment she had was managing the records of the other new incoming female Marines. And so she worked there through the conclusion of World War I, so up through November of 1918. Now, at that point, all the branches began discharging the women from active duty because as the men were coming back, they were retaking the old jobs and so forth. But she was still able to work for the government because she took a job based on her experience as a clerk then in the War Department, which it was the forerunner of the Department of Defense. It was renamed Department of Defense in 1949.
Can you tell us about the challenges that she encountered being the first woman Marine?
You know, it's interesting because she was facing a different set of challenges than a lot of the women in the field would face today. You know, we are in a time period, the last several years or so, where we've seen a large increase in the number of women on active deployment, combat missions, and so forth. She was working as a support staff and, you know, kind of at a time, ironically, when a lot of the men were gone. So there was actually a little bit more of an open-mindedness at that particular time, because they knew that they could rely on these women that had these administrative skills and secretarial skills. They'd been trained to do these jobs, and they were brought in, and it's kind of revolutionary that they allowed them to actively enlist at the time. And over time, you can kind of see this legacy of service that, you know, the Marines have this association of toughness and so forth, and now you've got places like ABC News and so forth who are profiling women on active duty and leading training deployments in the Marine. And it really is Johnson's legacy that, you know, she kind of broke that first barrier and taking jobs serving her fellow female Marines. And now we've got female Marines leading men and women in the field.
And so why would you say it's important for people to know about her, and how does she relate to today?
Well, you know, the Women's Marine Association in particular, you know, they really feel that connection. They really feel her legacy. She was actually buried in an unmarked grave in Rock Creek Cemetery in D.C. when she died in 1955. You know, and it wasn't intentional. It was just that was one of those things at the time that they had very small markers or so forth, or that there were lists of where the people were plotted if you didn't have a giant marker and so forth. But the Women's Marine Association last year ran a fundraiser to install an official marker and small monument. And they actually successfully funded it, and that site was unveiled on August 29th of this year. In fact, the current Commandant of the Marine Corps, who's General Robert Deller, spoke at the enshrinement of this new monument because they really appreciate that, you know, she's the first, and they're really trying to respect and honor this legacy that she started.
Can anybody go and see the monument?
Yeah, it is open to the public. The cemetery is open for visitors, and in fact, on the Marine Women Association Facebook page, they posted video and photos of the ceremony. So if you look at the Women's Marine Association on Facebook and look at fundraisers and so forth, you can find pictures of the event and the video of General Deller speaking and so forth.
What was it like for you writing the article? How did you do your research and get your information?
Oh, it was fun. One of the things that we do at the Saturday Evening Post, one of the taglines that we've always had is celebrating America, past, present, future. And so we try to pay particular attention to running down dates that might have been historically significant. I was looking at things writing about for that month, and I ran across this mention of Johnson, and I dug into it a little more, and I pitched it. And one of the things that I did was look up primary newspaper accounts like the Richmond one I mentioned earlier, and to see if there were books and so forth that mentioned Johnson. And I'm always attracted to the idea of firsts. You know, it's always interesting, especially in the context of, you know, talking about American history. Firsts are a big deal for us as a country. And it did tie in really nicely with the fact that, like I mentioned before, that we have been seeing this increase in the amount of coverage women succeeding in command positions in the military. You have to kind of appreciate how long that's actually been going on and all the groundwork that had to be laid for those things to happen. You know, I'd like to point out that since Johnson enlisted, we've had thousands and thousands of women that have served in the armed forces, both in combat and support. And as of 2015, which is the last year I had strong numbers for, about 2 million women in the United States are veterans. And I think that it's definitely important that we recognize those women. And as of May of this year, 92 women actually serve in combat positions in the Marine Corps. So that's only 7% of the Marine Corps as a whole in terms of active combat. But the idea when Johnson enlisted that there would be women serving in active combat as Marines was kind of as distant as putting someone on the moon. So the fact that she helped lay the groundwork for that, I think, is very important. It's important that we recognize what those women are doing today.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Hope you'll join us here tomorrow.